So again, if you practice compassion with the story, beings are being harmed, that takes you to the place where you have the story, beings are being harmed, but there's not a strong adherence to beings being harmed as applying to something. You don't adhere to that. You just say, I've got this story. This is my story right now. And you're practicing compassion with it, and now you're ready to see, this story has nothing to do with what's going on. And then you can really practice compassion because you're not stressed by grasping. And the story, beings are being harmed, it isn't that Avalokiteshvara, Avalokiteshvara, her job is to listen to the cries of the world, right? And she practices Prajnaparamita, right? But it isn't that she practiced Prajnaparamita and realized that all five skandhas were empty and relieved all suffering and then stopped hearing people. But it might be that she, as she was listening to the cries of being and as she was going deeper into Prajnaparamita, she might thought, if I go much deeper, I might not even hear people anymore. I might not hear the cries. And I don't want to stop hearing the cries because the whole point of this project is to hear the cries and liberate the beings. It's not just to hear the cries. It's to hear it and practice wisdom with it and relieve all suffering. But as she approaches seeing the emptiness of the cries, she might think, maybe I won't hear them anymore, and that wouldn't be good. But bodhisattvas are told, you don't have to worry about that. What you have to worry about is that when you hear the cries and you realize they're empty and you feel relieved, what you have to worry about is that you'll grasp the relief. That's what you have to worry about. And that you won't give up the relief and start hearing again. It's not that you won't be able to hear anymore, it's that you might feel like, I don't have to because I'm so at peace. That's a danger. You know, you're not going to lose your ability to hear the suffering of the world when you stop adhering to your version of it. That's not going to happen, but you might be afraid of it. What's going to stop is you're going to stop adhering to your story about what harm is as being something more than your story. That's what's going to stop. Not the story. The story's not going to stop. Or the story is going to stop, but then another one's going to come, as usual. Right? This is the latest version of beings who are being harmed. This is today's version of it. Like some of you maybe feel like beings are being harmed by snowflakes. I myself think that beings are being enchanted by snowflakes. But I haven't been living here with you all fall, all winter. But I don't want to adhere to my story that these snowflakes are delightful, you know, delightfully dancing in the sky. I don't want to adhere to that. And therefore, I don't want to adhere to your story being different from mine, even though it might be. I do not want to adhere to those things. Because if I don't adhere to them, then there will be some relief of affliction, but also there will be, even better than relief of affliction, there will be awareness of suchness, and suchness will develop not just freedom from affliction, but all kinds of qualities of Buddhas to help beings. So in order to really bring compassion and wisdom to the story of beings are being afflicted, we need to let go of the story, to strongly adhering to the story of beings are harmed as being actually having an objective basis. We need to let go of that, which temporarily, for the moment, relieves the practitioner of stress and then promotes the awareness of suchness and then promotes the continuation of the practice of the bodhisattva virtues in the face of all the innumerable stories of beings being harmed or anyway being stressed or being uncomfortable, being afraid. There's no end to them, and we want to bring compassion to them and wisdom to them. But if we're adhering, we can bring compassion to them prior to giving up adhering to the imputational character. We can do a lot of good prior to that, and doing that good brings us to the point where we actually can enter into suchness. And then we enter into suchness, we give that up in a way, and go back to looking at the images of these stories, these story images of the world of beings, and do the same practices, but now without holding to our idea of the practices. So we have a story of beings who are suffering, and we have a story of how to help them. Holding on to the story of how to help them is as stressful as this holding on to the story that they need help. We need to learn to give up both of those, and we learn to give them up by being kind to them. And being kind to them means not only being kind to the stories, but be kind to the holding them. We need, because the stories themselves are not really the afflictors, it's the holding that's the affliction. So we need to be kind to the stories of people doing well and the stories of people doing not well, and we need to be kind to our holding to the stories, which is the fundamental problem. And that holding comes because we do not yet understand conscious construction only. We have a misconception that this is not just conscious. My story is not just a story. That's a misconception. It's a conception, but then there's a misconception that this story is reality. That's a misconception. This story is more than just an image, more than just a fantasy. The imaginary quality of things is more than just imagination. But it's supported by something. It's not totally baseless. It just has no character of its own. It's characterless. So then you can abandon it. And when you abandon it, you won't cling to it. And when you don't cling to it, when you abandon it and don't cling to it, you get to see the thoroughly established. You get to see suchness. And this is now make these wonderful qualities in the same situation where before you were trying to be helpful, and that was good, but you weren't developing really any good qualities other than trying to help. Now you do the same practices, and they generate a new variety of benefit. That's the story. Extremely optimistic, but that is the story that I have. And of course, I aspire to not adhere to it. And if I don't adhere to it, you know what I think is going to happen. And this would be very good. Yes?
What about emotions? Would you say that all emotions are conscious constructions? I mean, I can see that they would be in the case of, like, fear a lot of times, but what about, love or some strong,
All emotions have three characteristics. One of the characteristics is the other dependent character. Emotions have an other dependent character. Emotions are not just, emotions are conscious construction only, but they're not just imagination. They also have the other dependent character. Emotions have an inconceivable character. Emotions have a character which is the way that they dependently co-arise. But they also have an imaginary character. And it's the imaginary character is the way we know them. So when you talk about an emotion, the way you know it, that's just imagination. But it's also another way that you don't know. It has another character. So emotions aren't it isn't that emotions are just your imagination. It's just the way you know them is your imagination. And emotions have another character, which is called suchness. Emotions have a character of ultimate truth. Emotions have a character, and if you see that character of emotions, you progress towards Buddhahood. Bodhisattvas watch this third characteristic of emotions. When there's an emotion, they watch the third characteristic. That's how they make Buddhas. But they can't see the third characteristic unless they have seen the first characteristic of imagination and let go of it. But all three, but even suchness is also just conscious construction only, because we don't want to make suchness into something substantial. But it's a different conscious construction from the other one. Suchness is the thing that bodhisattvas meditate on, knowing that they're meditating on conscious construction only, that makes them Buddhas. But they also meditate on their imagination of emotions. And they also meditate on the other dependent character of emotions, but they know that they're meditating on something that's inconceivable. So in the book I also mentioned, another way to say it is all phenomena have three characteristics: the dream, the mystery, and the absence of the dream. Everything's like that. Everything has a dream with it for us, for sentient beings. This is a teaching for us. Everything has a dream quality, a dream characteristic, has a mysterious, inconceivable characteristic, and it has an absence of the dream. And the absence of the dream is what purifies us, not of the dream, but it purifies us of clinging to the dream, and therefore it purifies the inconceivable of the affliction that comes from clinging to the dream as being the mystery. So an emotion is something that has these three characteristics. It has this magnificent, mysterious, inconceivable characteristic. It has an imaginary characteristic by which we can get a hold of it and know it. And it has this purifying characteristic, which is that it's free of the way we grasp it. That's what emotions have all that going for them. And not only that, you know, I say we're addicted to knowing, but there's another aspect of this which I propose to you, which poets tell us. Truth is beauty, beauty, truth. This is all you know on earth and all you need to know. This is a suggestion from the poet that beauty is seized by the imagination as truth. This is another kind of like testimony to how we might be addicted to making meaning out of things, is that the beauty of the other dependent character of an emotion, the beauty of it is seized by the imagination as truth. There's a beauty in the other dependent character of an emotion. Emotion has a beautiful quality. The way the universe makes an emotion is inconceivably beautiful. And when the imagination gets a hold of that beauty and seizes it, it seizes it as truth. So in a way, it's saying it seizes, but it's actually an imaginary truth. But also, you got beauty there, sort of. We're addicted to beauty, in a way. Or are we addicted to truth? We're addicted, I think, to getting a hold of beauty. And then when we get a hold of it, we think it's true, but it's not. It is true. It's a kind of truth. It's called conventional truth. It's conventional truth. But conventional truth will not liberate us from the suffering that comes from making beauty into something graspable. Suffering comes when we don't leave beauty alone and just bow to it. Like, I'm bowing to you, but I don't know what you are, but I feel like I should. When I was first with Suzuki Roshi, after being there not very long, he once said, when you look at a flower and say it's beautiful, that's a sin. And I thought, wow, that's very strict. But in a way, that's what we're saying here. When you look at a flower and you see the beauty and you want to get a hold of it, and you do get a hold of it and say beauty or wow, or any way you get a hold of it, it's a sin. But it's hard, you know, we like to get a hold of beauty. We like to get a hold of it and even like bite it. And then we think it's true. But this is what the poets tell us. But there's a teaching which says you should be kind to this situation and listen to that this isn't really true. It's just that it's more like a justification for our habit to grasp beauty and get a hold of it. But we shouldn't be mean to that. We should be kind to that and be kind to that and so on. Always be kind to it. Be kind to it, be kind to it, be kind to it. And then we can listen to the teaching which says, that is a truth. It's called conventional truth. It is truth. It makes sense. It works by the way we do this. It has a lawfulness. But you'll never be free of stress by this truth. The truth of grasping beauty by taking a hold of it so you can have it and then calling it true, that's affliction. But there's a way to become free of that. But not, you don't have to stop the process. The process will someday stop. But in the meantime, you can realize the emptiness of the emotion of the way you grasp it. It's not that the emotion is nothing. It's that it's empty of, there's an absence of the way you get a hold of it. So there's a way to get a hold of it. That's one characteristic of emotion. That's conscious construction only. That's the conscious construction of your projection. The beauty is also conscious construction only. It's not a substantial beauty, but it is this inconceivable. And then even the absence of the imputation is also just conscious construction. That's not a solid thing. It's all just conscious construction. It's like I said, the thing that knows the suchness is just the word wisdom. And if you can accept that, then you're actually not grasping the thing which knows suchness. So it isn't like, you know, we go over here and now we can start grasping stuff. Because it's suchness. Suchness you can grasp. Emptiness you can grasp. No. You can't grasp. You can't grasp pain. Ultimately, if you look carefully, you can't grasp pain. You can't grasp birth. You can't grasp death. You can't grasp nirvana. And you can't grasp wisdom. And that's why we start by mentioning you can't grasp wisdom, because most people don't have any wisdom to grasp to. So they're not that, you know, upset about it. But if you tell them that they can't grasp their pain, they really feel like, well, how dare you? Are you belittling, are you diminishing my pain? So we have to work up to that. But that's the point, is to work up to that.
Can I tell a small story?
A small story, yeah, go ahead.
As part of our building design process, I arranged to get a consultation with a sound expert. And so I had a meeting with him and what we were trying to do with the building, and then he he did that, he explained the science of kind of what different things would do to the sound. And as he would explain something, I would listen carefully, and then I'd say, oh, right. So in other words, the sound gets absorbed, for instance, I said once. And he said, no, the sound doesn't get absorbed. And then he re-explained it. And then that happened two or three times, and all of a sudden I realized I knew nothing whatsoever about sound. That all, in other words, my first of all, that I had a very shallow layer of understanding, which already was completely dissolved and deconstructed. So I had no more ideas about sound. And the other thing, and so that was one thing I realized. Another was that I realized that what I had had was the kind of pleasure of imagining that I understood sound. And that I sort of liked that feeling that among the huge territory of things that I understood, there was sound. And all of a sudden I realized that that was off the list. And as I did that, I experienced sound as a mystery, as something completely that I understood nothing about. And as I did that, I also had an inference that that was actually the way my understanding was about everything. So anyway, that was a little story.
Thank you for the little story. That was actually kind of little. And I'm not going to tell another one of those stories because it's getting late. But yeah, you're doing really well. Nobody's like fainted or gone to sleep. It's great. Thank you very much.